Not, I said. Here's a lesson we learned quickly. Your guidebook, especially when it's 5 years old, is at some point going to fail you. While the world's Hiltons and Sheratons with their breakfast buffets and Friday night poolside mariachi bands will probably be there for eternity, places like the Hostel Hermano and the Posada Guamanchi in the strata where rooms rent for $8 a night come and go. The doña who once fixed morning churros with sliced mango and hot coffee for guests leaves for an indefinite visit with her grandchildren. The elderly man who runs an immaculate and friendly guest house near the bus station hands it off to his son, who worries less about the spiders and roaches and the creeping shower mold and focuses on making late-night passes at all the tanned lady backpackers who, without an update in the guidebook, have yet to be directed elsewhere. In our first weeks in Venezuela, Jamie and I walked miles, strapped sweatily into our backpacks, looking for low-interest money changers and two-star posadas that had morphed abruptly into massage parlors or motorcycle repair shops. We waited at a roadside bus stop in the withering heat only to learn hours later, bickering and thoroughly sunburned, that the Tuesday afternoon bus to Caripe was now a Friday morning bus. After a time, we figured out the most accurate information could be milked from our fellow travelers. The Brits and Germans and Danes with their own tuberous luggage and varying tales of inconvenience and whimsy, which they were happy to narrate over pitchers of cold beer. We swatted mosquitoes and traded bits of highly subjective data. Anna from Portugal knew a good place to get laundry done. An Aussie named Brad had just come back from a mind-blowing trip to Angel Falls and said that everyone should hire his guide. Worrying became too much effort. When the bus didn't come, or the ceiling fan didn't work, or when a Swedish girl talked us into joining her and nine other backpackers as they hitchhiked a nighttime ride with a sea captain bound for Trinidad, and we ended up seasick and miserable on his treacherously seesawing boat deck. I realized, in the end, there wasn't much I could do about it. Travel was good for my anxious soul. Which is not to say that I relaxed completely. When we made land in Port of Spain, Trinidad, in the deep black of early morning, spattered in vomit and haunted by the ocean's violence, the port authorities handcuffed our boat captain right on the dock and marched the rest of us off to a detention center for not having visas. I did, in that moment, start to sob. But being in motion made me easygoing in a way I hadn't felt before. I relaxed my stance on fruit eating, for starters. The offerings were too rich and could be found on practically every corner. We ate meaty bananas and sweet green guavas. We pushed the Swiss Army knife into the thick rinds of fresh melon and used it to scoop the candy-like pulp out of yellow soursop fruit, landing it directly in our mouths. We'd also started to shed bulk and weight from our packs. We handed off our Tupperware to villagers, left Grandma Jean's jug of hand sanitizer in a filthy hostel, and gave a pile of clothes to an orphanage. Jamie's dark hair grew coppery and sun-streaked, his skin brown and sleek from days spent outside. I, too, felt tanned and lithe, as if I'd been born for warm air. The sun brought back the freckles I'd had as a kid. Jamie and I picked out the most captivating postcards we could find and sent them home with messages trumpeting the general magnificence of everything. On Margarita Island, on the north coast of Venezuela, we found wide, soft beaches and leggy palm trees that swished in the sea breeze. We pitched our yellow two-person tent in the backyard of a budget hotel for a week, striking a deal with the manager to use the bathrooms, paying under half the regular room rate. With the money we saved, we ate shark sandwiches and drank cheap rum at lunchtime. We became friendly with the local girl at the front desk, who collected our rent money every afternoon, stashed our passports in the hotel safe, and sold us bottles of water and golden empanadas filled with tangy cheese that she brought in a paper sack from her village. She was about 20, like me. Peggy was her name. She had round cheeks and a shy smile and stuffed herself into low-cut tops and long skirts. She spoke a stunted but versatile English. Her village was about 10 kilometers away. "Why don't you come there?" Peggy said one evening as I was trekking through the lobby with my toothbrush and contact lens case. "You can meet my family. We'll cook you food." In retrospect, it was a small thing to do, taking a taxi to Peggy's town, meeting her vast family of tios and tias and little barefoot brothers and cousins, allowing her to show us to a nearby beach, a 5-minute walk along a brushy path where we could pitch our tent for free. At the time, though, it felt large. The beach was a stunning half-moon of white sand rimmed by arcing palm trees at the mouth of a sheltered cove. There were no signs of human trespass, no bottle caps shipwrecked in the sand, no yachts drifting offshore. Peggy brought us a batch of doughy empanadas and sliced pineapple at dinner time, and with the sky starting to go purple and the evening breeze lifting, she left us. Our isolation was freakish and exciting. Jamie and I waded around in the warm water, watching schools of small bluish fish flick through the shallows. If we'd zoomed upward and looked back down, we'd have been half recognizable to ourselves. A young woman, a young man, caught in a textbook paradise, aimless and happy and utterly alone. It occurred to me that we were also unfindable, that without giving it a thought, we'd stepped off the traveler's grid. Peggy's village wasn't listed in the guidebook. We'd told no one where we were going. My joy dissolved quickly, my mind tracking through our inevitable disappearance. The police would find their way to the hotel we'd left and to our taxi driver. The taxi driver would lead them to the village. The villagers would point them to Peggy, and she would walk them to the beach. And there they'd discover us splayed and long dead in the sand, our tent in weathered tatters, Jamie and I having been struck by lightning simultaneously or drowned in the strong undertow and washed back ashore. Probably, though, it would be bandits, and the bandits would have been smart enough to march us off the beach before robbing us and killing us and burying our bodies where they'd never be found. I fell asleep that night petrified and uncertain, clinging to Jamie's back as he dozed in the tent, bolting upright every time the wind lifted the trees or a frog irped from the woods. This, I supposed, was what a frontier felt like, a knife point between elation and terror. We woke to the early sun blasting through our tent, the air inside steamy and suffocating. Jamie kissed my forehead. We'd survived. Of course. Something was unfolding for me, especially as one long bus ride led to a second and a third, and we floated ever deeper into Venezuela, following a loose plan but not a schedule. The effect was narcotic. I watched the countryside stream by in tangles of brush and dense cloud forest, punctuated every so often by the sight of a scarlet macaw or a small village built near a cacao plantation. The last bus dropped us off at a town called Santa Elena, near the border of Brazil. We found a hostel and slept under a tent of mosquito netting in a room painted a jarring shade of turquoise. The next morning, after some haggling, we hired a Pemon Indian guide and hiked off into the foothills. It was 2 full days of walking almost straight uphill along a switchbacking trail before I saw what I'd come for, the view from the top of Mount Roraima, which was less a mountain and more a mystifyingly huge plateau, a 9-mile-long, windswept slab of sandstone, so wide and high that it created its own weather. Its sheer walls dropped several thousand feet to the grasslands below. White waterfalls threaded down its sides. For 5 months, we'd sat with Roraima on our coffee table in our little apartment in Calgary, its pie-wedge shape occupying the pages of our most treasured issue of National Geographic. And now the looking glass had flipped. We were like fantasy characters climbing around a picture that had gone three-dimensional. Here were the pinkish quartz crystals spilled by the thousands across the slopes of a valley. Here were the jewel-colored hummingbirds and the tiny prehistoric-looking black frogs we'd marveled at in the photographs. "Can you believe it?" I heard myself saying to Jamie over and over. "Can you? I can't." The two of us sat on the rocky rim of the mesa, our feet dangling over the abyss, saying nothing. Below, clouds spiraled into tufts and pompadours, forming an eerie white fence line that cut us off from everything that lay beneath. It was as if we were poised at the edge of a witch's cauldron or sat at the prow of a great ship in the center of an otherworldly ocean. I had seen this place in the magazine, and now we were here, lost in it. It was a small truth affirmed, and it was all I needed to keep going. Chapter 5. A Haircut on a Lake. On our way down Mount Roraima, Jamie stumbled and broke his foot, causing us to cut short the rest of our grand South American tour. There was no talk of my continuing on without him. We were two rural kids on a limb, each afraid to make a move alone. We flew back to Canada, both of us tired. Somehow, even as we drifted through another year together and managed another backpacking trip, this one through Southeast Asia, the end of our relationship already felt pre-written. We were both restless, realizing we'd gotten serious too young. The breakup was painful and slow. When Jamie finally stormed out of our place one spring evening in 2003, saying he was leaving for good, what I felt was mostly relief. I tried to keep myself busy. I got a new restaurant job working at a place called Kaylee's, an upscale corporate hangout styled to look like an Irish pub, with planked wooden floors and piped-in jigs and shanties. The money there was better than at the drink. I took as many double shifts as I could, intent on saving for more travel. For the first time in my life, I was living alone, renting a tiny bare-bones apartment in downtown Calgary. Between restaurant shifts, I dipped in and out of the WeBook Inn, buying travel narratives and old magazines and stoking a new set of plans. I got a Lonely Planet guide for Central America, a brand new, updated one, and started bringing it to the restaurant to read on my breaks. At work, I'd become friendly with a girl from Vancouver Island named Kelly Barker. She was petite and pert-nosed, with electric green eyes that made people stop and stare on the streets. She had a long, trilling laugh, black hair that tumbled like a Brett girl's past her shoulders, and she never seemed to get tired. She did better in tips than just about anybody in the restaurant. One summer Friday, Kelly and I went for a late lunch at a restaurant called Earl's. Our restaurant had been quiet, and so was Earl's. We ordered artichoke dip and a round of high teas, a slushy tall glass rendition of the Long Island iced tea. I pulled the Lonely Planet out of my bag to show her pictures of Costa Rica, my destination of choice. Kelly had traveled around Europe with her family and done a student exchange program in Mexico, but she'd never backpacked. "I think I should come with you," she said. "Of course you should," I said. We calculated how much tip money we'd need to finance ourselves and how much time it would take us to earn it. We started by planning a 3-week trip, but three cocktails in, we decided we needed at least 6 weeks. I moved on to reading descriptions of Guatemala. Kelly removed her shoes and listened to me read as she fiddled with her straw. "There are swing bridges over a waterfall," I was saying, flipping pages. "Butterfly garden, coffee plantation. Oh, and it looks like there's a spiritual retreat where you can learn how to meditate and stuff." "Yes," Kelly said to all of it. "Uh-huh, yep. And I bet there will be boys in Guatemala." By the time our lunch check arrived, we'd scrapped putting an end date on the trip, and were now thinking we'd fly to Costa Rica, backpack through Guatemala and Nicaragua, and hop a flight to St. Thomas, where Kelly was positive we could get resort jobs that would have us waitressing right on the beach. From there, who knew? We blew through the door of the adventure travel company just before it closed, jovial and fully drunk and driven to make it all real before we thought better of the idea. Composing a serious face, I planted my elbows on the counter. "We'd like 2 tickets to Costa Rica for 6 weeks from now," I announced. Kelly stood next to me with a lopsided smile. The travel agent was only a few years older than we were, but wore a blazer and had a sensible haircut. She looked from me to Kelly and back, as if attempting to channel our mothers. "Please," I said, "we're 100% serious." Kelly was right. There were boys in Guatemala. About 5 weeks into our trip, having already traversed Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and Honduras, we rode several hours out of Guatemala City on a chicken bus, one of the old American school buses that totter around Central America, repainted in carnival colors, bearing rooftop racks mounted precariously with luggage and stray farm goods. We got off in a chilly Mayan town called Todos Santos, and there, in a damp little low-ceilinged restaurant with yellow walls, we happened upon Dan Hanmer and Richie Butterwick. Yes, Those were their names, like two characters out of my old Archie and Veronica comic books, like two boys in varsity letter sweaters, only they were British. Dan Hanmer was sandy-haired and blue-eyed and went to the University of Exeter. Richie Butterwick was a law student. Both had the ruddy glow of travelers, minus the backpacker grizzle, the unkempt, unshaved, beaded bracelet look that caused a lot of men, Kelly and I had decided, to start looking like trolls. They spoke in arch upper-class accents. They laughed and peppered us with questions as we unloaded our travel stories with the appropriate riotousness and charm, how we'd qualified for our scuba licenses in Honduras, been eaten by sandflies on the beach in Panama, and gotten caught in a nasty storm on top of a volcano in Nicaragua. For the next couple of days, the four of us went everywhere together, hitching rides in the pickup truck beds of Mayan farmers, watching horse races at a festival, hiking to some hot springs on a hillside between pink-flowering hibiscus. Richie Butterwick and Dan Hanmer were big laughers. They extended courtly hands to pull us into the back of the trucks. At night, lying on our beds back at the guest house, Kelly and I had fits of laughter over the scenario. We said the boys' names in British accents, adding, "Well then," and "Cheerio." The truth is, they were nice guys with interesting things to say. Also, something exciting was happening. As the four of us caught another chicken bus and relocated ourselves down the road to Lake Atitlan, as we piled into the overgrown patio of a little vegetarian cafe and ordered bowls of black bean soup with mounds of salty guacamole, as Richie and I continued to swill beer like old buddies, Kelly and Dan Hanmer had begun to stare meaningfully into each other's eyes. "Are you falling for Dan Hanmer?" I asked her as we lay in the hammocks outside our room one evening. Both Kelly and I had been living chastely as we traveled, flirting with male travelers, but always stopping short of an actual hookup. I was teasing her, and his name was just so fun to say. We would talk about Dan Hanmer for years to come, and he would always be Dan Hanmer. Never Dan, never that guy we met in Guatemala. "I am so not falling for Dan Hanmer," Kelly said in a way that was completely unconvincing. "No more questions." Lake Atitlan was a hypnotically shimmering blue-black pool of water cupped between three green volcanic mountains, with reedy shores and drifting fog and all sorts of honeymooners and hippies camped out in pretty little guest houses along the shore. The village we were staying in was a New Age enclave, with a meditation center where you could take classes in water massage and metaphysics. There were posters advertising sunrise ashtanga and cheap Indian head massage, and used bookstores carrying dog-eared copies of Kerouac and the Kama Sutra. Everyone we met announced the same thing. They'd planned to stay 3 days or 10 days, but were heading into their third week. It was a badge you wore. The more time you logged on the banks of Lake Atitlan, the more everyday obligations, the plane ticket home, leases on faraway apartments, relationships with faraway people, you allowed to slip away. Which, as the meditation people would say, left you in the moment you were in, not thinking backward, not thinking forward, just being peaceful, being present. Which was a pretty good excuse to do whatever you felt like doing. Dan Hanmer was now holding Kelly's hand everywhere we went. Meanwhile, Richie Butterwick and I drank a lot of beer and had a few makeout sessions, both of us knowing it would go no further, that we were just killing time. His flight was leaving in another few days to take him back to England, to whatever lawyerly life he would go on to lead. After we all said goodbye to him at the bus depot in San Pedro, I left Kelly and Dan Hanmer to their own private period of no backward, no forward, while I went to a different lakeshore village to reconnect with an American girl we'd met. There were only 48 hours before Dan Hanmer, too, had to leave for home. One of the best things you can believe about the world is that there is always, no matter what, someone worth longing for. 2 days later, when I took a water taxi back to San Pedro to retrieve Kelly, I found her sobbing on the stone steps that led from the waterfront up into town. She had indeed, at least for a moment, fallen for Dan Hanmer. And now Dan Hanmer was gone. "Oh, come on," I said, wrapping my arms around her, offering what at that point had become our all-purpose panacea. "We'll go have some beers." She pouted for the 20-minute boat ride back to the village and cried off and on as we sat eating a late lunch at a patio restaurant at our lakefront hotel with my American friend, a freckled yoga devotee named Sarah. Sarah and I fed Kelly another brown bottle of Gallo beer whenever she started to get misty. We avoided bringing up Dan Hanmer's name, but then we'd be talking about him again. "He played Bob Marley on his Discman," Kelly said wistfully, as if this were the single most romantic thing that had ever happened in her whole entire life. She would cry and then start giggling. Or she'd giggle and then start crying. Then all three of us would sigh. Dan Hanmer, for everything he was and came to stand for, was already a legend. Late in the afternoon, we wandered down to the rickety wooden dock that belonged to our guest house and sat listening to the licking water and the quiet buzz of fishermen's boats headed home for the day. Kelly's pretty face was bloated from all the crying, but she seemed done with it at last. Sarah and I were lying on the dock, chatting about whether we should stay in town longer and take a 3-day course in lucid dreaming at the meditation center, when Kelly's voice broke abruptly into our conversation. "I want you to cut my hair." Sarah and I turned to look at her. "What?" Kelly raked a hand upward through her hair and then let it fall, as if it weren't the down-to-the-butt envy of every woman she'd ever met, the glossy cornerstone of her beauty, but rather some sort of tiresome dish rag. "I want this gone," she said, "all of it." "No way," I said, "you're talking crazy." The idea of it was making her smile. I recognized the ignition point, a new flame running up some edge of Kelly. We eyed each other sternly for a good 30 seconds before I shrugged. "Just don't hold it against me when you hate it." This would become the thing I remembered, a memory I'd lunge for in my mind 5 years later, when I was locked up and kept alone in a rat-infested room in Somalia, when I was suffering and half-starved and my earlier life seemed like a made-up story. This warm early evening on a shimmering satin lake in Guatemala would feel like a fever dream. I would reach back for it, trying to lasso the small details and rope myself closer. Kelly and Sarah with their legs kicked out on the dock, their faces lit orange in the sunset. The way I ran barefoot up to the guesthouse lobby, borrowed a wooden chair and a pair of blunt-edged office scissors from a drawer in the front desk, and asked Kelly one last time if she was sure. There was the fact, refreshingly unimaginable given that one of my kidnappers had hit me so hard he'd broken several of my teeth, that the stakes of a haircut could ever have seemed so high. There was the specter of Dan Hanmer and the half-bloomed, eternally perfect love affair, and the first loops of Kelly's dark hair dropping heavily to the dock. There was the way the mountains angled like green drapery behind the sparkling eye of the lake. We were laughing at this point harder than I think we'd laughed all those 3 months we'd spent traveling, as Kelly sat in the chair and I struggled to hold the scissors steady, hacking off one thick tendril and then another, as Sarah, whom we'd never see again after that week, streamed tears of hilarity and clutched at her belly, and as Kelly, no longer heartbroken and still lovely with a shingled, jaggedy bob, reached down and swept the remnants of her hair into the big lake. Chapter 6. Hello, Madame. As I calculated it, 3 or 4 months of serving martinis to nightclubbers in Calgary would buy me a plane ticket and 4 or 5 months of travel. 6 if I kept the budget extra tight. "What do you do?" people would ask me casually, the way people do. New friends, the dentist, the woman seated next to me at a friend's wedding. Or, "What do you want to do?" was what people who came into the bar more often asked, presuming correctly that nearly everyone working there had other aspirations. "I'm a traveler," was what I'd say back. "I want to see the world." It felt exactly that simple. I'd made 2 trips to Latin America and 1 to Southeast Asia, and I was fully obsessed with doing more. Travel gave me something to talk about, something to be. That I'd just been to Nicaragua or was thinking about going to Ethiopia seemed, in the eyes of the people I encountered at work, to override the fact that I hadn't been to college or that I was late in getting a round of dirty mojitos to table 9. It helped erase the past, too, allowing me to duck questions about where I'd grown up or who my parents were. Among travelers, talking about the past usually meant talking about the just past. The expiration date on old experiences came quickly. What mattered most was where you were going next. In the late fall of 2004, when I was 23, I spent a month traveling in Thailand with my mother. We wandered beaches and Buddhist temples, ate curry and mangoes, and slept in three-star hotels rather than my usual budget backpacker places. My mother was a surprisingly mellow traveler. For the first time, she and I were learning to really laugh together, to excise some of the ugliness of the past. When she flew home, I continued on to Burma, where, still nervous as a solo traveler, I immediately grafted myself to a group of traveling geologists who were doing field research in the jungles. From there, I went to Bangladesh, in part because the flight was cheap and in part because it was on the way to India, where I wanted to go next. I had an idea that I needed to get better at being independent. I didn't know anybody in Bangladesh. I didn't know anybody who'd ever been to Bangladesh. It felt like the right next place. Bangladesh is one of the most densely populated countries on Earth, and Dhaka, where I landed in January 2005, is the country's most densely populated city. Walking from the airport arrival hall and into the swelter of the afternoon, I saw nothing but people, a few hundred of them pressed up against the black iron gates separating the airport from the parking lot. Taxi drivers, rickshaw drivers, unofficial baggage porters, women in bright saris clutching the hands of little children, vast families waiting for a relative to turn up. "Hello, madame," a man shouted, a hopeful taxi driver, it seemed. And then another, "Hello, hello, madame." And then more, "USA? Denmark? Where from? Hotel? Hotel?" On the plane, I'd met a man named Martin, a middle-aged German guy roughly my father's age who worked for an electronics company and did business in Dhaka all the time. "You're traveling alone," he said, lifting his eyebrows. "That's going to be interesting." Martin had insisted that a taxi ride to the old city and the $12 a night hotel I'd picked out of Lonely Planet would take 3 hours and the driver would overcharge me by virtue of my white skin and my gender. "They never take you where you want to go anyway," he said. "You'll end up at their cousin's hotel." He had a driver waiting behind the fence with an air-conditioned white minivan parked nearby. Walking out of baggage claim, I took one look at the taxi drivers scrumming madly for our attention and decided it was okay. A minor infraction of my mandate to be self-reliant in Bangladesh, to accept a ride in Martin's car. It took us 2 hours to crawl through Dhaka's traffic to the old part of the city, along the north bank of the Buri Ganga River, which was full of slow-drifting freight barges and ferrymen rowing blade-thin canoes over the mud-brown water. The sun was going down. The streets narrowed and the intersections between them were an unpatrolled bedlam of thousands of swarming bicycle rickshaws, honking vehicles, and wandering pedestrians. When Martin's driver found a way to ease the minivan over to a corner near my chosen hotel, I climbed out, hefted my backpack, and cheerily shook both men's hands. The noise around us was deafening, a cacophony of bike bells and blaring car horns, people yelling at one another, and some sort of shrill siren cutting through it all. Martin was sweating through his nicely pressed shirt. He had to shout so I could hear him. "Are you sure?" he was saying. "You don't want to just stay at the Sheraton?" I waved a hand as if I'd stood on this corner 100 times before. "No, no, this is good." Martin pressed his business card into my hand. "All right then, call if you need anything." With that, they drove off, and I was alone. Only, I wasn't at all alone. Every head on the street suddenly seemed to swivel in my direction. As I walked the 15 feet toward the sign marking my hotel, pedestrians stopped and stared. A round-bellied man was trotting behind me calling, "English? Hello? Hello? Hello?" I ducked inside the hotel and climbed a narrow flight of stairs leading up to a small second-floor lobby. Two men in white Muslim prayer caps sat behind a formica desk, watching a soccer game on a small television in the corner. The guidebook had identified this as a cheap English-speaking place with clean Western toilets. "Hello," I said. "I'd like a single room, please." I pulled out my wallet and passport. The older of the two men took a long look at me. He had deep brown eyes behind a pair of rimless spectacles and a sparse gray beard. "For you?" he said. "For me." "Where is your husband?" "I don't have a husband." The man tilted his head. "Then, where is your father?" I'd met young women travelers who wore fake wedding rings and pretended to have husbands stashed elsewhere, in an attempt to ward off men who believed that an unmarried woman who wasn't staying virtuously at home while her father negotiated her bride price had somehow been disgraced, and therefore was either a prostitute or a witch. I had always been irritated by this, thinking that the male attitude toward women like me was bullshit, and that the fake ring solution was not helping the cause. I was wearing a couple of rings on my right hand, cheap, chunky silver and rhinestone things I'd bought on the beach in Thailand, but I wasn't going to pretend they meant anything. "My father's home in Canada," I told the man a little hotly, "and I need a room, please." By now, the second guy had taken his eyes off the soccer game and was shaking his head slowly and silently, as if the very thought were preposterous. The older man leaned back in his chair. "What are you doing here?" he said. "I cannot understand it. Does your father know you are here?" He lifted his hands in the air with feigned helplessness, as if to say it was not his fault that my father had let me out of his sight. I did not mention that my father was home with his gay lover and that I was in Bangladesh on vacation from my job serving alcohol to unmarried young people who went out at night, largely looking to get laid. Instead, I continued to angle for a room. "I won't bother anybody. My money is no different than a man's money. What's the problem here?" At the same time, I was examining the hotel map in My Lonely Planet, relieved to see another recommended hotel a couple of blocks away. Giving in to what seemed like inevitable defeat, I descended the stairs in search of my next possible resting place. Old Dhaka smelled of diesel fuel and fish paste. Horns blasted and rickshaw bells jingled as I left the first hotel. It was early evening now. The round-bellied man materialized almost instantly, taking up his chant of, "Hello, hello, how are you, madame?" Within minutes, I was caught inside a swirl of inquisitive onlookers, a rapidly dividing cell of mostly men. A man with a neatly trimmed mustache and short-cropped hair had pushed his way into the patch of space where I was standing, the eye of our human hurricane. He wore a white prayer cap, but where the men at the hotel had worn loose-fitting Arab-style shirts and Asian-style lungi wrapped around their waists, he was dressed in jeans and a short-sleeved shirt. Excuse me," he said officiously. "What is your good name?" The crowd leaned in close to listen. "Well, my good name is Amanda," I said back, finding it funny, raising my voice over the noise. "I'm from Canada." "Can I help you?" I pointed at the map, turning the guidebook so he could see it. "I think it's just up here, right?" "Ah," said the man, taking the book and examining it. Someone from the crowd offered what sounded like advice in Bengali. More people chimed in. The Lonely Planet was passed around enthusiastically until a consensus appeared to have been reached and the whole knotty mass of us started moving down the block. The friendly man with the mustache introduced himself as Mr. Sen and trailed me inside the hotel. Another narrow flight of stairs, another tiny lobby with a formica desk, though this time there was a sofa, and on it, three dark-haired young men who looked like they'd been dozing. A fourth sat behind the desk. I asked for a room. The desk man pointed to my new friend. "This is your husband?" I sighed. "No, I need a room just for me." Mr. Sen jumped in, speaking a fast Bengali as the guy behind the desk waved his hands to indicate he was not in any way interested in renting me a room. Mr. Sen turned to me. "He is saying that if you have a husband here, then it is no problem." He gave a flustered smile. "Do you have a brother with you?" I could feel a small kernel of fear beginning to form. "No, no brother. It is just me, and I need a place to stay." Mr. Sen smiled again. "No problem, no problem," he said. He added, "You can come to my home. My mother, she will welcome you." "No, I can't go home with you. I need a hotel." I smiled, hoping not to offend him. "Please," I said, "I'm tired." We walked several blocks to the next hotel listed in the guidebook, me and an entourage of what had to be 40 Bangladeshi men, led by Mr. Sen, most everyone in the group seeming to be jabbering to somebody else about my predicament, calling out to others as we passed in the dusk. A woman was frying chili peppers over an open fire and selling them in bags to people headed home for evening curry. The scent nagged at me. I hadn't eaten since morning. At the third hotel, the older man behind the desk looked me up and down and then asked about my husband. I started to quietly panic. This was no lark. These people really were looking at me, with my harmless ponytail and jeans and battered blue backpack, with my hoop earrings and eager beaver smile, and seeing some sort of threat. I was not totally naive. I understood the intricacies here, at least a little. I understood that it was a culture built on modesty and strict adherence to Islam. Most of the women on the street wore headscarves. Some kept their faces completely covered. I had read about purda, the practice of shielding women's faces and bodies from public view. I was aware of how completely foreign I appeared. "Nah, nah, nah," the latest desk man was saying, waggling a finger emphatically as Mr. Sen mounted some sort of argument in Bengali. Their words hummed indistinguishably past me, a telegraph wire blur, until my self-appointed protector turned back to me. "You see," he said calmly, "it is simply not possible for you to stay," he added with a note of defeat. "I'm sorry." Not knowing what else to do, I dragged my pack over to the black vinyl couch along the lobby wall and plunked myself down on it. "I'll sleep right here then," I heard myself saying, surprised by the forcefulness of my voice. I fixed the white-haired hotel man with a stare. He looked away. I fought back tears. I crossed my arms over my chest, trying to appear formidable. "I'm not leaving," I said. The hotel man looked uncertainly to Mr. Sen for a translation. A quiet conversation ensued. The man behind the desk appeared to be weighing his options. After a few minutes, he signaled grudgingly for me to step forward and hand over my passport. His eyes stayed down. A rushed notation was made in the guest register. A small brass key was produced and passed to a skinny young boy in an embroidered skullcap who stood waiting by the stairs leading up, apparently with fresh orders to guide me to a room. The truce was awkward. The enemy was inside the gate. I thanked Mr. Sen warmly, taking care not to further damage his reputation by shaking his hand. I made an awkward bow in the direction of the desk man, and then wordlessly and gratefully followed the boy with the key upstairs. Once I got used to it, Dhaka excited me. I bought a sheer black headscarf and draped it loosely over my hair, like many Bangladeshi women did. I grew used to being the only Westerner on the sidewalk, the only woman in a restaurant. I strolled the Hindu market street, where clouds of incense wafted and jewelers in little stalls pounded silver. I stepped into one of the city's high-domed mosques, where, beneath an eggshell mosaic ceiling, rows of kneeling, murmuring men touched their foreheads intently to the floor. Islam was everywhere in Dhaka. On the mirror of my room was a small arrow-shaped sticker helpfully pointing the way toward Mecca. 5 times a day, the muezzins chanted and the prayers began. These moments were strangely private and public at the same time. The men in my hotel lobby, guests and employees, arranged themselves into a line and bowed in unison, unaware or unruffled by my presence. People, mostly men, were praying outside in the streets, outside of the mosques, which were often too small to hold everyone, especially on Friday, the Islamic holy day. I thought it was beautiful. The repeated bowing, the rows and rows of people humbled before God. After the bowing, they sat with their hands cupped in front of their faces in supplication, whispering a finish to their prayers. It was so foreign to me, a religion that required so much from its believers, this display of devotion every few hours. As a traveler, I was formulating an edge that would help me in years to come, finding and holding the line between the pleased-to-meet-you openness that both served backpackers and made them easy prey, and a more aggressive way of using my own power. Without the language or a way to pick up cultural cues, it could be hard to parse opportunity from danger. Your mind always had to be thinking a move or two ahead. I believe I was good at this for the most part. I'd spent enough of my childhood trying to read cues and navigate uncertainty. Uncertainty was what I knew. Back in my hotel room one evening, I heard a rustling in the hall and some raggedy masculine breathing. When I got up to investigate, I realized with horror that a man was lying in the hallway, his cheek pressed against the floor as he tried to see through the half-inch of space beneath my door. My first instinct was to scream, but I quickly thought better of it. The blame for any disturbance, I was sure, would fall on me. Any problem and I'd be kicked out, forced to make another humiliating quest for a hotel. I did what I always did when I was scared. I reminded myself to breathe, to ignore the tingle of anxiety, to settle back into my body. Calm, 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 I thought. And then I checked the lock on my door, dragged my chair out of sight of the doorway, and sat waiting for him to get bored and go away. A couple of days later, having wandered my way to the outskirts of the city, I flagged an auto rickshaw and asked the driver to take me back to Old Dhaka, to my hotel. No problem, he said as I climbed in. He was young, close to my age, I guessed, and I was tired enough that it took me 15 minutes to realize that instead of steering us into the dense city, he'd driven us into an outer ring of Dhaka, and the two of us were now, as night began to fall, traveling what was almost a country road, the city high-rises having given way to ramshackle huts and roadside food stands. I said, wait, excuse me, where are you taking me? The driver didn't look back. He waved a hand. No problem, he said. There is no problem, madame. In Bangladesh, there never seemed to be a problem. Or that was what everyone said, anyway. I spoke a little louder. I think you're going the wrong way. Please take me back to the hotel. In the city. The city. No problem, no problem, the driver said. He seemed to be driving faster. We rode on another few minutes as my neck began to tingle. Was this some kind of shortcut? Was I being abducted? Would I be killed and sold off organ by organ on the medical black market, as per the most popular backpacker horror scenario of the day? What was I supposed to do? What happened next surprised even me. From my spot in the back seat, I yelled, "You need to turn around!" For good measure, I leaned forward and slammed a fist into the side of the driver's head as hard as I could, the rhinestones of my cheap tie ring slicing thickly into his temple. I had never in my life hit anyone. Stunned, the driver slowed the rickshaw, reaching a hand up to feel the blood. I watched him examining it in the dark. My knuckles throbbed. A new paranoia buzzed. I had obviously crossed a line. Now, surely, this man was going to hurt me. But I was wrong. Without a word, the driver made a slow, arcing U-turn, and we began the long, silent ride back to Old Dhaka, where the streetlights and frenzied sidewalks gave me an odd kind of relative comfort. Reaching the corner where my hotel was, I climbed out, flooded with a mix of anger and relief. The young guy looked at me sheepishly. He had a deep cut above his right cheekbone. It was unclear what his plan had been, where he'd been taking me, and for what reason. Whatever it was, he'd been shamed. "I'm sorry," he said twice. He bowed his head and I turned away. I didn't give him any money and he didn't ask for it. Chapter 7. The Rule of Proximity. I had momentum now, for real. After 3 months in Asia, I was learning to navigate the backpacker ghettos, the chaotic crossroads for the world's wanderers that are found in nearly every big city. The streets stuffed with hotels that are cheap but not too dirty, with street vendors selling bootleg DVDs, used novels and guidebooks, flip-flops, luggage, fake Gucci sunglasses, and the billowy cotton harem pants that travelers buy to stay comfortable on overnight train rides but lapse into wearing everywhere. For the broke, there are Western Union offices. For the ill and anxious, there are pharmacies selling antibiotics and blister packs of generic Valium. For the planless, there are travel agents working out of kiosks, their sandwich board signs reminding you that with $200 you can get yourself to Phuket or Angkor Wat or Mysore. I tacked my way from Bangladesh into India by bus and train, arriving in Calcutta sometime in February and finding a room at the Salvation Army guest house in the heart of the backpacker ghetto. After Bangladesh, India seemed more user-friendly but no less crowded. Children tailed me down the street, calling "Auntie, Auntie," their palms held open for change. Men brushed up close, muttering "Ganja, Ganja, Hashish, Smoke." I spent about 2 weeks there, volunteering at one of Mother Teresa's charities, working the morning shift in the women's wing of the Kaligat Home for the Sick and Dying Destitutes, delivering tea and giving sponge baths to patients with tuberculosis, malaria, dysentery, AIDS, and cancer, sometimes in combination. The frankness of it was galling, even nauseating at first. But slowly I relaxed. I would never be saintly like the nurses who staffed the place, but I tried at least to be helpful. I was also getting used to being alone. What once might have overwhelmed me no longer did. I could read bus schedules, figure out the various classes of train tickets, ask for help when I needed it, sit in a restaurant and eat a meal alone without feeling self-conscious. I was learning to seize my opportunities. My mother was not a worrier exactly, but she did want to have a sense of where I was. As I moved around India, she sent me encouraging emails. She expressed her love. I wrote similar things back, often copying my dad and Perry. I sprinkled my emails with descriptions of what amazed me most. The honey-colored camels ambling around Agra, or the snake charmers plying their trade on the Varanasi ghats. The flower garden brightness of Indian women in their saris. I used a lot of exclamation points to illustrate how great it all was. Tomorrow, I wrote to my parents from an internet cafe in Agra. I am going to a different city called Jodhpur. It's a city in the desert called the Blue City, as all the buildings are painted blue. I'm having the best time ever. And I was. I was meeting people from all over the world. Some nurses from Australia, a couple of Israeli teenagers on leave from the army, traveling with them for a few days or a week before parachuting off again on my own. Riding the bus one day in Calcutta, I struck up a conversation with a fellow Canadian. A blonde guy in his early 30s with a resting blue surfer boy eyes, and ended up having a several-month mini love affair with him. His name was Jonathan. He carried a black canvas backpack and a guitar. I was a sucker for guitar strummers. Since my breakup with Jamie, I'd been guarded around men, unwilling to jump into the ongoing carnival of traveler romances. Sex on the road seemed, for a lot of long-haul travelers, like a given. The pints of beer and warm air, the months passed without a haircut or a good shave, the boastful chit-chat and dazed hours spent at bus windows all lent themselves to a certain sexual ease. The options were almost too exotic to be ignored. I'd seen Chileans wander off with Danes, old men and young women, older women with younger men, men with men, and women with women. And every once in a while, a boozy international threesome tiptoeing back through the tamarinds to somebody's room. I wasn't against any of it. I had just never been all that self-assured. If I got involved with a man, even briefly, I usually ended up feeling over-attached and extra vulnerable. I wanted to be more like other girls my age, able to have fun and move on, but it didn't happen easily. With Jonathan, who was extroverted and not serious about anything, I did learn to lighten up a bit. I had fun and never once asked myself if I was falling in love. We were both so devoted to solo travel that we saw each other only every few weeks, arranging by email to meet up for a few days in one city or another before moving on alone. People would say to me all the time, it must be so hard to travel by yourself as a woman. But I was finding that it was easier. I was sure about it. If you smiled, if you showed people that you were happy to be there, you were met most often with warmth. The swindlers backed off easily. The tuk-tuk drivers and beggars eased up and became more human, maybe even a bit protective. Nothing slowed me down. I took a train to Varanasi, a holy city for Hindus, thought to be a direct portal to heaven. There, pilgrims sat half-sunk in the gray-green water of the Ganges, washing their bodies, washing laundry and dishes, washing cows, while dead bodies burned on the ghats above. I went to Delhi, Mysore, Pushkar. I learned to sleep on trains, to not think twice while using the toilet holes that emptied directly onto the tracks rushing below. I tried the southern beaches of Kerala, where the lip of the Indian Ocean foamed over long stretches of white sand. Here's the rule of proximity. You get to one place and it becomes impossible, basically, not to start looking at whatever else is nearby. Climb to the top of one mountain and you see the whole range. If you make it as far as Cambodia, what's keeping you from Malaysia? From Malaysia, it's just a little hop to Indonesia and onward from there. For a while, the world for me was like a set of monkey bars. I swung from one place to the next, sometimes backward, sometimes forward, capitalizing on my own momentum, knowing that at some point my arms, or more accurately, my quivering bank balance, accessed through foreign ATMs, would give out and I'd fall to the ground. Pakistan was next to India, unignorably so. There were plenty of reasons to avoid Pakistan. If you read the news or listened to people sermonizing about the state of the world, Pakistan was a big fat problem. There were bombs on buses, headless bodies turning up in ditches, landmines, kidnappings. Al-Qaeda was in Pakistan, Bin Laden was in Pakistan, and the Taliban was in Pakistan. Nobody there, it seemed, was to be trusted. Still, people went. I'd met a couple of travelers in India who'd been. And I met people who knew people who said they met a guy a week earlier who'd just come over the border from Lahore, or had a friend who'd gone 6 months ago. The word on Pakistan in this context was always positive, an interesting bass line playing beneath a more familiar song. The place was amazing, untouched. The food was awesome, the people friendly and welcoming. The headlines were the headlines, as ugly and frightening as they were anywhere. The country itself was supposedly something very different. I sent my mother an email telling her I was headed into Pakistan to travel around. Well, in Delhi, I'd gotten a visa. And now I was in the far northern Indian city of Amritsar, 17 miles from the Pakistani border. Her response was swift and emotional, announcing she did not want me to go. She garnished the request with a thick wedge of guilt. I would never want to change you, Amanda, nor would anyone else in your family. But I want to ask you to put the shoe on the other foot and consider us and our feelings before you go. I can't help but feel physically ill to think of the danger you'd be in. She went on to compare my travel plans to sex without a condom. Reckless, in other words. I read her email and thought about it. I tried to put the shoe on the other foot. But it didn't work. My mother and I were closer than we'd ever been, and yet images of Russell, of his leering relatives, his piled-up liquor bottles, reeled through my mind. We weren't safe then. What right did she have, I was thinking, to worry about it now? In Pakistan, I felt like a bird on a limb, perched and ridiculously light. Lahore, where the bus from northern India deposited me, was a booming modern city. With Dunkin' Donuts and KFC near my cheap hotel, it was more familiar, less exotic, than most of the cities I visited in India. Immediately, I started to erase any fears, chalking up all the warnings to Western paranoia. I kept the argument going with my mother silently for days. What was reckless, I decided, was the way people were writing off huge swaths of the world as unsafe, unstable, unfriendly, when all they needed to do was go and see for themselves. It was Sufi night at my $3-a-night hotel in Lahore. The hotel manager corralled a bunch of us travelers into a van and took us to a mosque where, in a buggy outdoor courtyard, men pounded barrel-sized drums while others shook their bodies, whipping themselves into a state of spiritual ecstasy. The drummers chanted, "La ilaha il Allah." The hotel manager translated, "There is no God but Allah." Meanwhile, I deliberately ignored my mother's emails. Rightly or wrongly, I was punishing her for trying to put limits on me. I let her marinate in her worries as I took a 2-day bus ride from Lahore to Gilgit in the Hunza Valley of northern Pakistan, where I met up with Jonathan so we could travel up the Karakoram Highway, a slim ribbon of pavement cut between some of the highest mountains in the world, connecting Pakistan to China. As instructed by Lonely Planet, we flagged down a northbound truck on the highway, a jingle truck, one of the ornamented transport rigs common in Central Asia, with chains and bells dangling noisily from the bumpers to help shoo away animals in the road. The driver slowed and halted. He climbed out, a smiling, mustachioed man dressed in a sand-colored vest over a white shalwar kameez, and gestured for us to climb the metal ladder that led to an open-roofed cargo space above the cab. It was another daydream actualized, pages from my guidebook from the magazines opening into something real. For the next week, Jonathan and I caught rides on different jingle trucks, roller coasting through the mountains towards the Chinese border, climbing off at little villages to rest and eat. There were so many trucks and so many drivers happy for the novelty of loading foreign hitchhikers into their rooftop holds that we started to be choosy, waving down only the flashiest, the most overdone vehicles. The trucks had quilted, sequined interiors and were hand-painted in carnival shades of orange, blue, green, and red. The larger panels held vividly detailed murals of hopeful things, peaceful landscapes, pretty women, verses of the Quran, and bold, lidless eyes meant to ward off evil. The drivers, usually two to a truck, tended to their vehicles as if they were children. They passed pillows up to us in the cargo hold to make sure we were comfortable. They passed up cigarettes, candies, and lots of apricots. When we offered to pay them, they almost always refused. We communicated in gestures and bits of basic Urdu and English, stopping at roadside stands to buy oily plates of chicken karai, so spicy it made my eyes water. In motion, we swerved to avoid herds of yaks and goats, oncoming trucks, and tractor-sized boulders that had tumbled off the steeple-like mountains and slammed into the road. About 5 months after Jonathan and I rolled up the Karakoram Highway, the biggest earthquake in a century would hit the same part of northern Pakistan, flattening villages and triggering massive landslides, killing some 80,000 people. It wasn't that we were unaware of the road's various perils. The reminders were there, from the overturned Suzukis and shattered guardrails to the tiny stone pyramids meant to memorialize someone's death. The possibility of disaster sat at the edges of our days, but never moved closer. Children sometimes chased us, throwing rocks in our wake, though it was impossible to know if they were angry or playful. Jonathan and I were blithe because it was easy to be blithe. One good day reinforced the idea that the next would be good, too. Already, in my mind, I had half composed an email home, in which I would narrate the thrill of the adventure, packaging it up for my mother. This little triumph, the one she tried to talk me out of. When maybe a week later, having parted ways with Jonathan, I found myself in the city of Peshawar on the far western edge of Pakistan, at a linoleum-floored restaurant with a dial-up connection and an ancient-looking computer in the corner. I sat down to write it. I was dazzled still by the highway and the mountains and the fact that nobody knew where I was. What I sent off to both my mother and father was a big, overdecorated jingle truck of an email with the subject line, "I love Pakistan." In it, I detailed how I was eating heaps of delicious street food and wandering the market alleys on my own, waiting among a sea of people, friendly people, I made sure to say, more open and warm than in India. Midway through my note, I announced that I was going the very next day to apply for a visa to visit Afghanistan. Another place I'd heard was better and richer than the headlines it earned about troop movements, suicide bombs, and the ongoing search for Osama bin Laden. It was a day's bus ride away. I ended the email by proclaiming myself the happiest I've been in my entire life. The jab was intentional. In case anyone missed my point, it was followed by four more exclamation points. Chapter 8. Don't fuck with Afghanistan. Right as I was planning to leave for Afghanistan, a woman disappeared in Kabul. She was Italian, 32 years old, an aid worker who'd been living there a couple of years. Walking along the pedestrian mall in Peshawar, I'd happened to buy a Pakistani English language newspaper and read the story. The article was short and not on the front page, but there it was. Her name was Clementina Cantoni. She'd been dragged out of her car in the center of the city one evening by four armed men, put into another vehicle and driven away. Beyond that, nobody seemed to know a thing. I went back to the ratty dorm room at my guest house, which I was sharing with about 10 other travelers, and studied the newest visa pasted into my passport. It had an official stamp in purple ink, blurred slightly at the edges. The particulars, the date, my passport number, my nationality, had been filled out in black pen by a consular employee. Mrs. Amanda was granted a month to travel freely in Afghanistan. Tourists did go to Afghanistan. I'd met an older British couple in a camper van who'd driven through the country without incident. They checked into my guest house, plopped themselves on a couch in the common area amid a group of motley backpackers smoking hash, and gushed about the Blue Mosque in Mazar-i-Sharif and the flowering hillsides of Panjshir. It was all I wanted, to see these things, to leap another hurdle, but the kidnapping story nagged at me. It was as if an invisible branch had snagged my collar. I felt fear, but also something else, something missing, a sudden absence of conviction. A doubt when I wasn't used to having doubts. My grandmother, I knew, would have labeled it a much-needed attack of common sense, but that, to my mind, was code for being afraid of new things. I spent a week considering my options. I left Peshawar and headed away from Afghanistan, taking a few long bus rides to get myself all the way across Pakistan and into India, figuring I'd see the mountains of Ladakh. I was scheduled to fly home from Delhi in a few weeks to resume my life as a waitress. Already, the prospect seemed dull. On an overnight bus, I found a window seat and proactively piled my belongings high next to me to discourage potential seatmates.